What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
What's going on, everybody? We've got a special bonus for you here on the podcast feed this week. We are releasing in full the latest edition of Top Rope Nation Unplugged. That's Jesse's weekly bonus show over on our Patreon feed. Here for everyone to hear. I thought this was a particularly fun episode. Hope you all enjoy it. Jesse has a great guest on the show. It's Stephen Conway from the Speaking of Strong Style podcast. And they go back in time and review one of the all-time classic matches in pro wrestling history. It's the iconic Misawa versus Kobashi bout from Pro Wrestling Noah on March 1st, 2003. Now, this is part of Jesse's 40-match project that he's doing in 2026 and that he has been doing this year over on our Patreon feed. In fact, Justin and I will be on the show in the next couple of weeks as part of the project to talk about the Bret Hart-Steve Austin match from WrestleMania 13. So if you want to have access to upcoming episodes of TRN Unplugged, TRN Extra, TRN Classics, ad-free editions of the weekly flagship show, make sure to sign up and support us on Patreon. This is just a little taste of what patrons get every single week. So hopefully you enjoy it. Click the link in the broadcast description if you want to sign up and support us and get this bonus content all the time. Enjoy.
Back in the days when I was young, I'm not a kid anymore, but some days I sit and wish I was.
Episode 209 of TRN Unplugged. I am your host, Jesse Velasquez, sitting in a different studio today. Much better lighting than what you're used to. And this will be show number one out of two this week. I'm going to be doing some current stuff on Thursday. I'm heading to Dynamite tomorrow night here at the Roy Wilkins Auditorium in St. Paul, which I'm super excited for. And today we're going retro. So we've been doing this. We have now condensed it to 40 matches to cover this year, 2026. And this is match number five. And with that, I have a repeat offender who has also seen live wrestling here in the last week, and we'll get into that in a moment, but I'll reintroduce him to the crowd, Stephen Conway from Speaking of Strong Style. How are you this evening?
Hi, I'm very glad to be here. I'm excited to be talking about this match and Japanese wrestling as a whole, so I'm pumped up. And we were talking very briefly before we went on the air about how a match like this will get your blood flowing. And I watched it, of course, earlier today, so it would all be fresh in my mind. Seen it many, many times. And it just never gets old. This one is one of the greats. So I'm fired up to spend some time talking about these two wonderful workers.
And before we talk about those two, I was going to ask you, we did talk about it off air a little bit, your experience with Tokyo Joshi Pro Wrestling in Texas last week. You want to go over a little bit of your experience?
Oh, yeah. They were here for South by Southwest, the big festival that we have here, the Tech Movie and Film, Movie and Film are the same thing, isn't it? Music Festival is the other part of it. And they did two nights at a convention center here and drew very, very well, almost 2,000 the first night, about 1,500 the second night. and they brought their brand of mayhem here to South by. It was very interesting to see, just because TJPW, owned by the same people that own DDT, also the same people that own NOAH. And in the DDT sense, there's comedy, there's well, they have an idol group that comes out and sings to start the show. There's a lot of wackiness. And then when they get down to business, they have some excellent, excellent workers as well. So you see a mix of everything. And they did a great job promoting it, because the people that showed up were festival goers who were curious, and also some people who are into just Japanese idol anime culture. You saw some people cosplaying as characters at this event and things, but a lot of the people came there with a very open mind and responded to everything and seemed to really enjoy it. And the wrestlers seemed enthusiastic about the crowd. So very positive experience. I've seen them in Korakuen Hall in Tokyo, their big show, Grand Princess, which is January 4th every year. It's right before Wrestle Kingdom at Korakuen Hall. So you can go to one, walk out of Korakuen Hall, turn left, go about 100 feet, up a flight of stairs, you're at the Tokyo Dome. So I just went from one to the other real quick that day. And it is a wild show. TJPW is never dull. And it's like getting three shows at once, because you really do get the wackiness. You get the idol culture stuff. And then Miyu Watanabe, Suzume, Miyu Yamashita. I don't want to just throw out a whole bunch of random names, but there are some real top-of-the-line workers. And so when they have their title matches and decide we're going to wrestle now after having a lot of fun, they're on the level of a lot of the top people in all of Japanese women's wrestling. So quite a show, really enjoyed it. And if they come around toward you, because they seem to be doing these little mini tours of America once in a while, they'll be at WrestleMania weekend, for instance, if you're in Las Vegas for that. I recommend it. It's you will not be bored, and they keep their shows to a nice tight 2 hours. It's good stuff.
That does sound like good stuff. And just that, a wide variety that you're talking about. I've seen clips of, I haven't seen a full show of DDT, but I mean, everybody knows, especially if you're a wrestling fan, the viral clip of Kenny Omega wrestling a blow-up doll.
Yes, of course. Yeah, DDT straddles the line in particularly between being a pro wrestling company and a parody of a pro wrestling company. And sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fall off that line. That balance beam is not always friendly to them. But when it clicks, it clicks. And TJPW a little more on the wrestling side with some wackiness, and DDT's kind of a lot of wackiness with some occasional wrestling.
Hey, their audience knows what they're getting, which is it's awesome. On brand all the time. So
yeah, absolutely right.
And then final question before we dive into the meat and potatoes. What year did you go to Korakuen Hall to watch Tokyo Joshi Pro and then head to Wrestle Kingdom?
To TJPW, that was that would have been in the very beginning of 2025. So not this past year, but the year before. I was there for the Shota Umino Zack Sabre Jr. match. Jeremy, my partner, and speaking of strong style, was there for Tanahashi's retirement. I think he got the better end of the deal, but I still had a lot of fun. I went to All Japan, I went to Stardom, I saw seven shows while I was there. All the companies run Tokyo that week. It's similar to WrestleMania weekend here, when you have the main thing in the big stadium, and then in venues all around town, all the other companies come in because people like me show up from America, and then people come in from all over Japan as well. So everyone was running Tokyo that week, and I saw as much of it as I possibly could. Yeah, I saw, All Japan, Stardom, and TJPW, and then three New Japan shows, because that was a two-night, they had Wrestle Dynasty the next night, and then New Year's Dash. So I was among my tribe. I was in Hog Heaven. It was great to hang out, and you really do meet a lot of people. Because, Jesse, how often in our lives do we meet people who are as into this as we are? Like, among our friend groups, we're the ones that are the experts on it. We have our 10,000 hours in, and everyone else is kind of, I watched wrestling when I was a kid. You're like, okay. Go to Wrestle Kingdom weekend or WrestleMania weekend, and everybody knows everything that you're talking about. It's kind of refreshing.
That is so great. I'm going with three other people to Dynamite tomorrow night, and I would say one of the other three has a lot of experience. He is in his early 50s, I believe, 52-ish, and he's been watching wrestling since the late 70s. I mean, he could, and he even said, this is his exact words are, I really don't like 2026 pro wrestling right now. I go back and watch Abdullah the Butcher. I go back and watch stuff from the 80s and Mid-South, and that just lights my world on fire.
I feel for him. I feel for him. I do the same thing. I started in 83. I started in 83 when I was eight. So I can relate to that. And sometimes, though, it's healthy to go back and watch the stuff you fell in love with. When the current product isn't making you happy, it's easy to get bogged down in the negatives and the stuff you don't like and what's quote unquote wrong with it. And I always tell people, if they're feeling burned out on wrestling and just not enjoying it, but you still want to see some wrestling that you like, don't be afraid to go back to what you fell in love with in the first place, because it probably holds up more than you'd think it would if you go back and watch that stuff on YouTube and things. So I think he does the right thing. Go back and watch some Abdullah, watch some stuff from the early 80s, late 70s, because you'll remember the feeling of catching it for the first time. And then you watch it with a little more knowledge of it now, and you learn what's going to happen to these guys later, and it puts it in a different context, but you still have that feeling of being a little kid watching wrestling.
This is really setting the stage for what we're about to talk about. I got one more question, because this is bringing to my mind. Since you saw an All Japan show last year, what were your thoughts on the presentation of current day All Japan?
Current day All Japan has some terrific workers, one of the best in the world, Kento Miyahara, a rising star in Yuma Anzai, who's going to be a top level guy. And they have a tag team that's very charismatic, the Saito brothers that get over. They don't have a ton of depth. And the thing is, Noah is owned by CyberFight, which is a large company, bigger than Bushiroad, even the company that owns New Japan. They don't have the budget. And it's tough for them sometimes. They have some good foreign guys, a lot of ex-NXT guys. If you remember Odyssey Jones, and they have Zion Quinn. He's in All Japan now, if you remember some of those guys from NXT. And they're doing well. It's just a more narrow roster. So when they have injuries, it hurts them more. They just don't have the depth and the budget. But the current presentation is very straightforward and similar-ish to what Baba was doing back in the day, in that there aren't really baby faces and heels. There are alliances, but you sort of pick your group that's your favorite more than anybody cheats or puts feet on the ropes or interferes or anything like that. There's a little bit of that, but very little. For the most part, you just kind of pick your favorites and go with them. And the emphasis is on telling the stories in the ring. And that is still the same. I enjoy All Japan. I have their streaming service and I watch it. The issue with them is, again, they just don't have the depth. So whereas up and down, when New Japan is really clicking, and frankly, as somebody who watches all of New Japan, I'm a completist, it hasn't been clicking all that much lately. But, you can get a show like Dominion, Wrestle Kingdom, where six matches of them are terrific. In All Japan, sometimes before intermission can be a little on the rough side. And then, And they had a young talent who was unfortunately killed in a tragic accident last year. So that was one that was sad. The company bus, the ring bus, or the bus that either transported the wrestlers, the one that transported the ring, hit him, and he ended up dying of his injuries, which was tragic. So they've had some obstacles to overcome this past year. But I still like All Japan. And Noah's trucking along as best he can with a fairly old roster, frankly. But all of that kind of comes together in the match we're about to talking about, because it's two guys who made their names in New Japan and then were the beginning of what was a golden era for pro wrestling. Noah, the early years of Noah were pretty great stuff.
Yeah, that segue is perfect. So as most of you know, I've been hyping this for a couple of weeks. The match we are going to go over today took place March 1st of 2003. Mitsuharu Misawa versus Kenta Kobashi for the GHC Heavyweight Championship. That's Pro Wrestling Noah's title. And we're going to tie in a lot of things here early, give you some snippets. And the question first and foremost, what was your introduction to the Four Pillars?
The introduction to the Four Pillars for me came with tape trading when I was in college. And I was in college. My friend Ron Whitworth, shout out to him, introduced me to The Observer. Whole new field of research opened up. And I'd been a wrestling nut for a long time. And I watched everything that I could get my eyes on, really. And I grew up in an area where it was basically WWF. And if you had cable, you could see TBS and all that. But the Observer kind of woke me up to all the things that were going on. And I had the kayfabe wrestling magazines. Mm-hmm. I was aware of some of the names from Japan, but I hadn't seen them. There just wasn't a place to see these guys. When I started tape trading in college, there were compilations, tapes that were floating around. And there was a guy named Bob Barnett, I remember this, that you could buy compilation tapes of Japanese wrestling as they kind of came out. So people would tape Japanese wrestling. Bob would kind of cut it all up, New Japan, All Japan, and put it together in a four-hour compilation a month. And you could get that. And so I would send away for those, and this was putting a check in the mail, sending it away, hoping he gets it, cashes it, and then a few weeks later you get. So I would get tapes like 6 to 8 weeks after they happened, but that seemed pretty current at the time.
Yeah.
And that was in the middle of all of the rise of the Four Pillars. So I was in college from about 93 to 97. And in that time, that was when Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, really, and Taue, all that rose to the top after Jumbo Tsuruta got sick and had to kind of move aside from the main events. And it was like seeing something state of the art after you had been, drawing water out of a well. it was just so, it blew my doors off, because American wrestling at the time, WCW was struggling. The NWO angle hadn't happened yet, and they were having house shows with attendance in the hundreds. WWF, you're talking like the era when everybody had a part-time job, the wrestling garbage man, the wrestling plumber, the wrestling, it was so kind of more for kids than it was for adults. And it wasn't clicking. That's where ECW came from. ECW mm-hmm. is the punk rock of pro wrestling. And that had a cult following, and Smoky Mountain was still around and all that, and doing a more traditional version of pro wrestling in a territory. But nationally, it was rough. So then you would get this tape, and you would see 10,000 people at Sumo Hall for New Japan, which had Muto and Chono and Hashimoto and their Three Musketeers, and then the Four Pillars for All Japan in front of 16,000 people at Budokan Hall, going nuts. And All Japan women, for that matter, goodness, Aja Kong, Manami Toyota, and Akira Hokuto. These tapes were the cure of what ailed me. It helped me to continue loving pro wrestling when what I was seeing on national TV was not real great. No Steve Austin and Stone Cold Steve Austin yet. He was still Stunning Steve Austin and, losing to pretty weak guys because they just didn't know what they had. And WWF was rough. So seeing these guys just changed my view of pro wrestling. So I could love pro wrestling again, watching the Japanese stuff, and been into it ever since.
I don't blame you. I like the kayfabe magazines you mentioned. You'd see the names all the time, and mm-hmm. you would see them when the PWI 500s would come out. They would be in the top 10, 15, 20. I'm like, okay, who are these guys? Why? Yeah. How can I get access to them? So I was in my teens and wasn't quite into the tape trading piece yet, but you always had respect for them if you truly knew about and wanted to know about professional wrestling. So, I mean, Misawa, Kobashi, Taue, and Kawada were household names in my mind. My question to follow up is, and this, could come down later in the line too, but of the Four Pillars, who is your personal favorite?
Mitsuhara Misawa is my personal favorite. In fact, since we're doing a video thing, this is how much I'm into this. On the wall behind me, I'm a bad weather man, but that's Mitsuhara Misawa's autograph. I bought that at 2-2-0-con. That's Stan Hansen and Giant Baba right there in that one. And then this one over here, nope, this way. I can't even do this. This is terrible. Kenta Kobashi right there. And the other thing is, this ticket in this little frame right here is from the very first Noah show in history. I bought that at 2-2-0-con too. So it's a stub from the very first Noah show. And so that's how much I love this stuff. I went to 2-2-0-con and got their autographs. But Misawa in that green and silver, it's so interesting because he's not particularly expressive in his face. He's very reserved. And yet he's one of the most charismatic wrestlers I think I've ever seen. There's something about the way he moves, the way he's suddenly quick. He can go from 0 to 60 very fast. He just kind of explodes into people. And his sense of timing is on the level of guys. You hear about Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair having perfect timing, you know, knowing exactly when to do the right thing in their matches, and it's true. Misawa is absolutely one of those. Kobashi was almost as good. But there was just something captivating about Mitsuharu Misawa. He was the second Tiger Mask, so he could fly a little bit. By the time he gets to the top main event of All Japan, he bulked up a little bit, wasn't flying as much. But his technical wrestling was outstanding. His high spot wrestling was incredible. I mean, we're going to talk about these suplexes and the drops and everything else that, led to some pretty rough times down the road. But in the moment, it was thrilling. And his matches just had an aura about them. His rivalry with Kawada was unparalleled at the time. His work with Kobashi as a tag team, incredible. And then when they were against each other, even better. And he brought Jun Akiyama along. So of the four, it was always Misawa for me. And Kobashi, Kawada, and Tawai, love him. But he was always one, and the rest were 1B, C, and D to me. It was tough, but I love Misawa.
Misawa's my guy, too. I got to see him live in 1986.
Oh, I never did. Oh, he was at the Superdome. He was at, Superdome, the Metrodome. He was at for the AWA. He and Baba came in, didn't they?
They did.
Oh, he's Tiger Mask. Yes.
Yeah. It's sad who he wrestled, unfortunately. Buck Zumhoff.
Yeah, well, you know.
Can't win them all.
Less said, the better.
I know. But at the time, I look back at it now, I go, I got to see Mitsuharu Misawa live, and just as a five-year-old at that point, just going and having no idea who he was, and looking back at it now, just the true appreciation of it too. And you go back through Misawa's career, because he started as a junior, segue into this, and the parallels with Misawa and Kobashi are kind of frightening, in spite of the fact they're 5 years apart. Both of them grew up in single-parent homes. Which was, mind-boggling to me. And then just finding professional wrestling at a teen age when both of them were pretty athletically inclined. And they were discovered as well by Giant Baba, both of them, I believe. I know Misawa was trained by Dory Funk Jr., Baba, and the likes. Can you recall who Kobashi was trained by?
Kobashi did some with those guys. Masafuchi was a big influence on Kobashi's training as well. He was one of the elder statesmen there in All Japan. Great worker. And he helped train Kobashi a lot. Yeah, it is those parallels. You're absolutely right. There are also some differences. Of course, Misawa was a good, really good high school wrestler. So was Toshiaki Kawada. They went to the same high school. The idea that a high school produced both those guys is crazy. They're about a year apart. Kobashi, though, was like working at a factory and was rejected multiple times, whereas Misawa and Kawada were had a smoother ride into the dojo. I mean, getting into the dojo is hard, and being in the dojo is even harder. But Kobashi had to really work for it. There's a story about Kobashi trying to get with that with All Japan and Motoko Baba, Baba's wife, who was ran the company with Baba. It was a true mom and pop operation in that sense. Just said, he's lifted some weights, but he's not. He's not the athletes that Misawa and Kawada were. He comes from this poor area. He's working at a factory. And I've heard a couple of different stories, but most of them revolve around them telling Kobashi to get to an impossible show if he wants to learn anything. Just like, show up tomorrow at noon. We're having a show in who knows where Japan, impossible to get to. This kid will never show up. And he got there, and he turns up, and they're just like, well, he wants it, put him in the ring. And then they got a look at him and said, oh geez, he's good looking. He's athletic. He's got a bodybuilder's physique. Maybe we should do something with the guy. And he's hungry as hell. So he got himself in that way, but you're right. He and Misawa coming up from, that's not an easy upbringing anywhere, but a single parent household in Japan, really rough and fairly rare at the time. And for them to kind of power through all that and get to All Japan is impressive.
Yeah, I can't imagine that at all. And I'm going to go back to Misawa. Like after he left the juniors or was promoted, mask was taken off. I think what was cool was who he wrestled in the States. He wrestled Kurt Hennig, AWA champion, I believe at the time. Ric Flair. He's wrestled Bret Hart. Which I heard the match isn't that good, unfortunately.
It's not. It's a 20-minute draw, and they just didn't click. And I'm not joking. Those are probably my one and two favorite wrestlers of all time. You can throw in Dynamite Kid in there and a few others, but I was stunned when I saw it. I've seen that match, and it doesn't click. It seems like it's absolutely can't miss, but it missed.
Oh, it's so unfortunate. And then the one that I just found out about a couple of days ago, and I don't know if I could dig this up, he wrestled Ricky Steamboat when he was in the NWA.
Yeah, he did. And in Tutuokan, I mentioned that store, they actually sell replicas of the mask he wore in that match. It's not the mask. I asked. I was going to buy it. I ended up buying this Bushi mask right here instead. But that was a big deal that he wrestled a Steamboat. And talk about two of the best baby faces of any generations.
And it sounded like that one actually had some good reviews on the match.
Yeah, that was good. That one was a good one.
Gosh, Ricky Steamboat. Yeah, miss him too dearly. He was a tremendous performer in those days too. Yeah. So with Misawa then, and I think talking about kind of that transition period in the early 90s when Tenryu and Jumbo Tsuruta were up top. And then you mentioned Jumbo Tsuruta going through some health issues. The timing was perfect for these four guys. And Misawa ended up being the chosen one in the early stages. And I think it's been proven correctly that they made that right choice. But how often do you strike gold like this? I mean, I could, like the WWF or WWE, I felt did with Orton, Cena, Batista, and Shelton Benjamin. I feel to a lesser extent. But like how often does this occur in wrestling?
Yeah, not often. And we mentioned Tsuruta, but Junichiro Tenryu was a huge star for All Japan for a very long time. And he and Riki Choshu, when he was in All Japan for a few years, had a great feud. The Tsuruta and Tenryu rivalry, more than a feud, always drew. All Japan was not on the rocks. They were doing well. And yet, there was a guy who was very, very rich and wanted to start a wrestling company. And he started a wrestling company out of nowhere called SWS. And he convinced convinced Tenryu to leave and be the number one guy. You don't have to share the spotlight with Tsuruta or anybody else for that matter. You are the top guy for me. And he left and took several members of his faction along with him, saying, hey, we're all going to go over here and be the top dogs. And that left a gaping hole toward the top of the cards, which they filled with Misawa. Misawa did a feud with Tsuruta that was pretty scintillating, and he brought Kawada and Kobashi up as part of that. And Taue was actually the young guy on the Tsuruta side back then, so that was their early clashes. But yeah, you're right. That they probably would have risen to the top anyway on pure talent, but it was pretty amazing that the clouds kind of cleared out for him, because Tsuruta and Tenryu were not doing poorly and probably would have stayed on top for a few more years before age totally caught up to him. And then things might have ended up very differently. But as it turns out, just as these guys were hitting their prime, the spots up at the top of the card opened.
Gosh. Yeah. And Misawa defeated Tsuruta in 90.
Yeah.
So Triple Crown going from there.
The first time since the very first Budokan Hall show that anybody won their first Budokan Hall main event. Because the very first All Japan Budokan Hall main event was won by Baba. No surprise there. So was the second one and the third one. It was not until Mitsuhara Misawa that they won, that somebody came up and the very first singles main event at Budokan Hall, they won it. Very first time since the very first show. So that was a shock and a big deal. If you watch that match, when he gets that pin, the crowd reacts like their team just won the World Series. And I use that term because Japanese baseball is the biggest sport there. It's that match too. Absolutely electrifying, because everyone sort of expected Misawa to wrestle well but fall to the established guy at the end, because everyone does in their first Budokan main event. That getting the Budokan Hall main event is the achievement at first, then you get your first win later. And instead, Baba went with the hot hand, and the place just blew up. It's one of the most emotional scenes you'll see.
Gosh, yeah. That's something I'll have to watch tonight, I think, before I go to sleep.
That's a great one, too. You're not going to be disappointed.
Easy one to find, for sure.
Yeah, that's all over the place.
So Misawa, Golden Boy, I mean, we all know about his Kawada match in June of 1994, the rivalry there, and just how impressive that was. Let's go to Kenta Kobashi. I think this is a stat that I always talk about. He lost anywhere, depending on the record books you see, either his first 59 to 62 matches.
Yeah. That was Baba. We're used to seeing young lions lose now.
Sure.
And it was a little bit different back then. They didn't just job the guys like crazy for a while. And the fans understand the young lion process and they don't hold it against him and all that stuff. But they were telling a different story with Kobashi. He always fought valiantly. We talked about Misawa not being particularly expressive. Kobashi is expressive as hell. His face will tell you every single thing that man is feeling in that moment, whether it's agony, hope, it's all in his eyes. It's all in his mouth. He radiates it. And they knew that. And so they just decided to make it the slowest burn ever. And he always came that close and then not quite. And he would lose over and over again. And yet the people never gave up on him because they were so convinced that he was good. And he was. And Baba knew that he was good. And so they were just saving it for the right moment. And they just told the story that this guy will never quit, telling the fans that this kid will never give up. And it worked. That's a risky move. Somebody drops 63 straight matches, you really run, or however many it was, you're right, it's all over the place, but you run the risk of people kind of saying, well, yeah, let's not get too into this because he always just loses. Kobashi was able to carry him along. He always did something to give him hope that, oh, maybe this is the one. No, it's not. and yet when it finally did, they were all over him. And when he won, there are tears in the eyes and, they're throwing babies in the air and it's, parades breaking out.
That's unbelievable. I don't know these days, like if there is a certain performer out there that could kind of pull that off, just lose a whole bunch in a row and people just write them, especially in 2026 with the advantation of the internet and everything.
That's what I'm saying, that the fans in each individual town weren't aware that he was 0-45 or anything like that. They had just seen him several times and he hadn't quite gotten the win. And, I don't think they didn't watch every match. Like right now, if you're a New Japan fan, you see every loss these young lions get. And that wasn't the case back then. So maybe even though they were kind of aware that he hadn't won yet, maybe they'd only see him a few times. And each time he was getting a little closer. So that hope was there. I think you're right. In today's time, when you can see everything in every match, I do think that eventually people would just kind of burn out on it. But not then.
No, it's different times. And yeah, I think we'd go over the accolades right now too for both of these guys, with Misawa being a 5-time Triple Crown champion, also a 3-time GHC heavyweight champion, whereas Kobashi was a 3-time Triple Crown champion. And what we're going to get into, the longest reign in the history of Pro Wrestling NOAH, unless that's been eclipsed in the last handful of years, 735 days. So at that time, just unprecedented.
Yeah, I'll bet it hasn't been eclipsed. I wouldn't put the house on it, but I don't recall a champion holding it that long in NOAH in the last few years. So I think it's probably still his.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage 1. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
And you mentioned at the top that these guys were tag team partners as well at one point in time. Kawada and Misawa, I believe, were tag team partners first.
Footloose.
And then they broke off. And
yeah.
Kobashi and Misawa were a tag team. But what's crazy, I think, is the chemistry between these two. Misawa and Kobashi. I mean, Misawa and Kawada, you could argue that, I mean, that feud is probably better. And I think from a match catalog perspective, I think it just depends on apples and oranges to each person. There were, at the time before this match happened, there were 16 singles matches. Misawa won 12 of them. Hmm. One draw, and then three Kobashi victories. So, I mean, Misawa obviously being the top guy at that time. And here's the thing, before we hit the 2003 match, these guys had back-to-back years of pro wrestling, or the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Match of the Year. Halloween of 98, and then June 11th of 1999. So the chemistry obviously is undeniable between these two. And do you have any recollection of any of those matches before we hit 2003? And we're going to talk about Noah in between as well.
Yeah, I do. What I recall about that is, we mentioned Misawa teamed with Kawada for a while, and then they split up, and they don't, New Japan, or All Japan, excuse me, didn't do turns. One of them didn't backstab the other. They just went their separate ways, so to speak, and then developed that incredible rivalry with Misawa and Kawada. While he was feuding with Kawada, he was, or his rivalry was with Kawada. Again, there weren't sneak attacks and stuff like that, but Kobashi was teaming with Misawa during that time against mostly Kawada and Tawai. After that sort of ran its course, they wanted to make the big rivalry Kobashi and Kawada, so they put Misawa with Jun Akiyama. So over and over again, Misawa ends up with these absolute brilliant talents to work both with and then against. And so I do remember those, because you would see Kobashi working with other guys against Misawa and Akiyama, and then they would come together for these singles matches, and they had the Champion Carnival every year, which was their tournament, you know, the G1 of All Japan. Although back in the day, you would have said that the G1 was the Champion Carnival in New Japan. But yeah, it's just these rivalries would go from tag team partners to rivals. And then when they would meet in the ring, I do remember those matches. The Triple Crown was so prestigious, and it was defended so rarely. Yes. You know, only a handful of defenses a year. Every single one of them was special. And I talked about those tape trading days. When you got a Triple Crown title defense on a tape, that was a big deal. I used to have friends that would come to my apartment to watch those when I would finally get them on grainy VHS. I joked before that it was 10 years before I knew that Kobashi was handsome, because he was just this fuzzy face in orange tights on my crappy VCR for a long time. But the matches between Kobashi and Misawa, that's when the wrestling, or the Japanese wrestling world, would stop. And that's when you would check the Usenet groups to see who won the night after and all that. You would just, you went out of your way to make sure you caught that one. That one was one you weren't going to miss. And every time they got in the ring, they had something special, and they would build on whatever they had done before. The finishing move from the match before would get countered into something special in the next one. They were, your diligence was rewarded. Every single little thing you noticed was rewarded with something that they would come back to later. And it was just storytelling that you weren't seeing much of. It was just a different level.
That's what makes it so compelling to me. And you mentioned at the top, the stories told in the ring, and All Japan still continues to do it. Mm-hmm. So Kobashi wins the last Champions Carnival for All Japan, or at least one before, and this is the perfect segue as well. Giant Baba passes away in 1999, and you mentioned Baba's wife earlier, that she was given control of the company, and then Mitsuharu Misawa apparently was having some disagreements and decided he was going to go start his own promotion, and here we have Pro Wrestling Noah. They defected in the, what would be the late spring of 2000. And then I believe one of the first cards was in August of 2000. Yep, but right, can you kind of give me your recollections of like the differences between Misawa and Baba's wife?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Because throughout all of that, no one ever said what they were fighting about. We never really learned, because it's fascinating to me. First of all, the parallels. Misawa is one of the top guys in the company. He is frustrated with the way the company is being run. He goes to the television networks and says, I'm thinking about starting my own thing. And the television network says, well, no one pays to see the owner. You're the star. If you do, we'll go with you. and we'll broadcast your TV. Exactly the same thing Baba and Inoki did in 1972. Exactly the same thing, step for step. And so that's how we got All Japan and New Japan in the first place, because they were all sick of the JWA. And but the difference is, when they got to Noah, the only thing that was really different than All Japan was that wrestlers from other promotions sometimes went to Noah. And that didn't happen. And if you were either an All Japan guy or you weren't. And like the foreigners didn't really work for other Japanese companies at the time. Steve Williams and Terry Gordy, Gary Albright was a big one. Johnny Ace. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those guys were in All Japan then and nowhere else. When Noah started, they would have guests from other companies in sometimes. Other than that, the presentation was pretty much just like All Japan. So my question has always been, what did Motoko Baba want to do that Misawa didn't? And we never found out. And it's the great unanswered question for me, is like, what direction did she want to take it? Whereas he basically just said, I'm going to do All Japan, the Baba style All Japan, except I'm going to invite people from other companies once in a while. And people have mentioned, well, they also elevated some juniors like Kenta and all that. And that's an interesting point, except those guys were so good and in the dojo, like what the hell else were you going to do? I mean, you got guys like, you know, Kenta, he's can't miss. So, you know, yeah. So I think Kenta would have been elevated by All Japan anyway, maybe made into a heavyweight or something like that. But Kanemaru was there. I'm trying to think. Oh, Marufuji, of course, you know, another great junior talent. Mm-hmm. That was one thing. But I think that was just circumstances where the best guys in the dojo were smaller guys. And, you know, I don't know that Misawa sat there and just said, I'm going to create a junior division, or if that was just those are the three best guys in the dojo. Ishimori was part of that later on, too, mm-hmm. by the way. And by the way, his abs are as glorious in person. Just as glorious, maybe more so. A marvel. That guy's almost my age. Not quite. Sorry, Taiji. You're not quite as old as I am. But
he's mean.
Mm-hmm. Oh, ridiculous. And, you know, Kanemaru is Uncle Kanemaru. But those guys were great talents, and everyone knew that they were great talents in that dojo. They stood out. So, you know, was that it? Was that he just wanted a junior division? But no one's ever said. And it's just fascinating that they presented a product that was a lot like All Japan. So what were they fighting over? We'll never know. And we'll never know. And both of them passed away.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go with this, was I felt that the only difference was the junior division was highlighted a little bit more in Noah in the early onset stages.
Yeah, All Japan never really, I mean, they had smaller guys, but never really did a whole lot with them. Certainly not compared to New Japan, which had the game-changing junior heavyweight division where you got Tiger Mask and then Black Tiger, Mark Rocco, and Dynamite Kid. Later on, Liger and Otani and, you know, some of the El Samurai and some of those great, great junior heavyweights. For God's sakes, Eddie Guerrero was the second Black Tiger. I mean, that was mind-blowing stuff in New Japan. And Baba sort of just kind of ceded that territory to Inoki and said, well, that's what they do. So that's probably the main difference. But booking-wise, very similar.
Yeah, and I was listening to a podcast a couple of days ago, and actually, and Eddie Kingston was a guest star on this one, and he is oh my gosh, yeah, like he could rave about that for hours upon hours. Mm. He said the biggest difference between New Japan and All Japan was, this was what kind of Baba's preaching, is that All Japan wouldn't do any submissions. Like that just wasn't part of King's road. It just made them made the talent feel inferior, where his talent feel inferior, whereas in New Japan, like Masachono, STF was a major finisher for him too. So I found that pretty captivating, just interesting to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a time when they really did a big submission. Gary Albright would use it sometimes. And of course, you know, Kawada used the stretch plum, mm-hmm. but I don't recall him getting a stoppage or a submission off of it now that you mention it. Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, New Japan, because Inoki was so into MMA before MMA was a thing, he was always into stuff like that. I mean, when they did the collisions between them and UWFI and UWF and all that, they used a lot of, Kaiji Muto used the figure four to beat Nobuhiko Takada in the Tokyo Dome. That's the funny thing, isn't it? We're talking about All Japan and this run that they had with these four pillars, And they had an insane Tokyo sellout streak where they sold out hundreds of shows in a row in Tokyo and these Budokan halls, 16,000 people. They were the number two company. At the time, New Japan was running the Tokyo Dome three times a year and almost filling it. It was such a boom time for Japanese wrestling. But that's an interesting point about the submissions, that Inoki always had that MMA mix in there. And guys would use a lot of submissions. And I guess All Japan, once they went to the pinfall thing, because, man, the double countouts in the 80s were torture. In the big events, man, they protected the hell out of those guys. And if you had two top guys in, it was almost certainly going to be a double countout finish type of thing where they wouldn't beat either one of them. Once they got away from that, yeah, it was pinfall. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
And we covered Inoki and Vader at the beginning of the year. Inoki wins that match by submission.
There you go. See, yeah, maybe that's just how they felt like they should differentiate themselves.
Cool way to do it, I suppose. I mean, that's, yeah, big, small difference there between the two companies. With Noah now, and right before we hit the match, just Misawa ended up becoming the first champion in 2001. And there were a handful of other champions, but Misawa was already a two-time champion by the time they rolled into this. Now, he is a beat-up version of himself from All Japan. Now, here's the big one. Kenta Kobashi has now, before this match, he's had 12 knee surgeries.
Bloody hell. I didn't know it was 12. 12. I didn't know it was 12. Ugh. Yeah, we talked about this with the boom period starting in 93, 94, and Misawa a little bit earlier than that, but Kobashi really blossomed 93-ish. Well, this is 2003. These guys have worked one of the roughest styles anyone has ever seen that we'll get into once we start talking about the particulars of the match. And they've been doing it for 10 or 15, in Misawa's case, 15 years. And he and Kawada were doing opening matches in the very early 80s. And so a lot of miles on these bodies, a lot of impact. And these were not simple flat back bumps they're taking either. No. So it's kind of amazing they made it as far as they did.
I mean, look at back to Misawa Kawada in 94. I believe was it the introduction of the Tiger Driver 91? Where he just dropped Kawada on his head.
And just dropped him flat on his head and looked for everybody that won. He kind of botched the move.
Yeah.
So the first time I saw it, I thought they were so sweaty that he slipped and dropped the guy on his head. No, that was the friggin' move, because he did it again later. You're like, oh my God. Even back then, I was like, holy moly, that was scary. And then another time in the Tokyo Dome with Kawada and Misawa, Misawa went to get out of the power bomb by turning it into a Hurricane Rana. Kawada stops him so that Misawa's got him by the waist, and Misawa is just straight up and down. So picture trying to do a Hurricane Rana and the guy just catches you. Doesn't go into the forward roll, right? Just catches it. And they just drop Misawa on the top of his head and just had this big spot right there. They would plan spots where they're dropping each other on their head like that. That was the first Tiger Driver 91, but it wasn't the last one. And some people call the Tiger Driver 94 because that's the year it happened, but it was the 91. But anyway, semantics. Semantics. But, so they were already putting those kind of bumps on each other 10 years earlier. And the human body is not designed to withstand that.
No, absolutely vicious stuff in the mid-90s when, like you said, All Japan was at its absolute height. And the plan, according to just history and what I've read, is that Misawa wanted to go with Kenta Kobashi very early on in Noah. Mm-hmm. And all these injuries prevented him from doing it earlier. And he had missed, I think, close to a year, 2001 to 2002. He gets back, and then he misses another 4 months with another injury. So you have to wonder at this time, like, how can he withstand this punishment, or can he be the flag bearer if we're going to have to worry about his injury history?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And you think about it, maybe Misawa's point of view of it as president of the company is, if we don't do it now, we might never be able to do it with him. And so going into this match, he's closest thing to healthy he probably got after all that. And just thought, well, let's strike while the iron's hot. We do have Jun Akiyama coming, and he can carry the joint. But he might have just thought, if I wait another 6 months to a year, Kobashi might never be healthy enough to run with it for a while. And you have to keep things fresh on top once in a while. So he had, like you mentioned, 700 plus days. You can only do that for so long before you kind of run through every challenger you have. And my guess is they may have pulled the trigger on this just thinking that it might be their only chance to do so with Kenta Kobashi.
Oh, just picture that too. And he had to adapt his style a ton when he got back in, because I recall the Kenta Kobashi doing moonsaults and all of these other things. And was Taue or Kobashi taller? I know Kobashi had a thicker frame.
I think Taue was a little bit tall. Taue was a pretty tall dude. So I think Taue was a little bit taller than Kobashi, but not terribly.
No, I mean, to me, I mean, this is maybe apples and oranges as well. Kobashi might have been the most athletic of the four. Misawa's pot. I don't know. That's kind of up for debate too.
Yeah, that's a good question. But his knees were bad. I mean, I remember him having a heavy knee brace, and then the magic numbing spray, spraying that on him after matches, going back to when I was watching him in college. So those knees were rough early, and he was still doing the moonsaults on him and everything else. So,
oh, unbelievable. Which we have arrived. March 1st, 2003. We both talked about how, yeah, this definitely got our juices flowing. Like, I watched this yesterday afternoon, and I almost wanted to go back and watch it again. This thing lasted close. No, it was 33 and a half minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, from the opening bell itself, they locked up, slowed it down, and Kobashi misses a chop early on, goes for a back suplex. Misawa counters with a crossbody for a two. Nice slow pace to this with a series of hammerlocks and a tie-up. I mean, both go for a twisting arm drag, series of reversals. They're flashing back to stuff from the mid-90s when they were younger. Misawa is 41 here, I believe. Kobashi's 36. So it's almost like for one night they were able to turn back the clock again. Is that kind of the vibe that you got throughout this match?
Yeah, I think so. And I like that they started with a couple of fast sequences. That, you know, like you say, he missed the chop, ducked out of that, and they kind of stared at each other and waited for the crowd was into this from go, probably before go, for that matter. They were going nuts before they rang the bell. And then they did a couple other things where it was a bit of a scramble and neither one had the advantage, and they would kind of come up in a neutral spot and kind of like their fists are cocked at each other, and then they would kind of stop and start again. And then once they started working, they slowed the pace down. Like you mentioned, they knew they were going a half an hour. And All Japan and Noah main events always went over 20. You know, that it was very, very, very rare that one went under 20 minutes. And the crowd kind of knew that, you know, that you would hear them kind of at that 20-minute call. That's when the crowd starts really coming up, because the 20-minute call are like, hey, you might actually pin him now. But before, they were kind of going with the story. So, yeah, they worked the hammerlocks, but they kept it going. It was never dull. It was just
no.
It was just kind of very well worked and deliberate, and they were sending messages with everything, but you're right. They did slow things down a little bit because they knew they were going to go along.
And the one thing that I gathered, because the two guys know each other so well, is that Kobashi was going for the neck and Misawa was going for the arm.
There you go. They're going for each other's quote-unquote weak points. Weak points in storyline, but not the weakest part of their bodies. Misawa didn't pound away at Kobashi's knees as a key. Although, working Misawa's neck doesn't age well.
No. We're going to keep going here. Yeah, you mentioned it, which I completely forgot to. The moment the bell rang, the crowd was going crazy.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen too often. I mean, this was a 16,700 person crowd here for this Noah main event as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and what was cool to me is that the crowd would trade chants for both men throughout this match.
Yeah.
You said there's really no face, no heel line between the two. And just compelling stuff.
Yeah. All Japan did rivalries more than they did good guys, bad guys. So the fans would pick their favorite guy, and I'm team Kobashi tonight. I'm team Misawa tonight. But it wasn't like they were, they didn't hate each other. And even when Kobashi and Misawa were really at each other, or Kawada and Misawa in particular, at each other's throats and things, it was always a little bit respectful. This is, I'm not going to shake your hand too much. I don't really, you know, I have to beat you. It's more of a, I have to beat you. It's not that I want to put you out of wrestling. It's not a personal issue in that sense. So the fans just kind of picked whatever they want. And then after a while, it felt like they were just rooting for whoever was selling to come back. That's kind of how it felt a couple of times. If some guy stayed down for any length of time, a Kobashi chant or a Misawa chant would come up. And sometimes it sounded like some of the same people.
That's what just made this so fun. Honestly, yeah. You rooting for both guys. The first high impact move of the match itself was Misawa. And what did he do here? So he went up top, he scored with a back suplex as Kobashi rolled out to the floor. Then he goes up to the top. He hits a dive onto Kenta's chest. That's where you mentioned it. The crowd starts chanting for Kobashi. Misawa gets back up and hits an apron senton and knocks Kobashi to the floor. Eventually, Misawa would hit a middle rope splash as Kobashi was getting back in the ring for a two count. And then, as I was talking about the arm work, Misawa with an arm breaker, and Kobashi holds his shoulder as he's going to the rope. He's continuing to work on the arm. So we're getting chops, forearms back and forth. I mean, this is, again, all within the first probably 7 minutes. Just good stuff so far. Sure. Do you notice anything else in those opening minutes?
Yeah, no, we talked about it a little bit that they started off with a couple of quick things, but then they weren't in a hurry, pacing themselves. They've done this a lot, you know, between tag team main events and singles main events. They know how to work a 30-minute match. They know how long they're going. And so they're pacing themselves, but throwing in things that will matter later.
Oh, and then there's other things. We get a forearm from Misawa knocking Kobashi to the ground. And big move here as Misawa hits the ropes, does a senton. So he holds the ropes, just kind of that whole flip, and he jumps out to Kobashi, who's near the guardrail. And Misawa lands jaw first into the guardrail, probably broke his jaw. Blood just spewing out of his mouth. You can kind of see first huge move of this match. And right away you're like, okay, we could be in for an epic battle between these two. I just saw the cringe look on your face there. Is that what you displayed this afternoon when you watched it?
You could feel his face bounce off of that thing, the jaw bounce off of that metal barricade right there. He hit it very hard, and I hope he just split his lip and played it up with that. But yeah, you could easily break a jaw doing something like that. He smoked that thing.
Yeah. Again, big move here. So with a mouth busted open, Kobashi takes advantage and hits a released German suplex about a minute later in the ring, and Misawa does a 180-degree flip, landing face first. Now the crowd starts chanting for Misawa.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, this is so fun.
Yeah, the momentum swings are fabulous. No one really holds the advantage for more than a couple of minutes.
Kobashi's throwing these wicked suplexes. I mean, both of these guys are just throwing just the kitchen sink at one another. Kobashi hits a face down suplex for a two count. They'd eventually go outside to the ramp, and Kobashi hits a DDT on the ramp and throws him back into the ring for another two count. Like, there's just, again, the high impact from these two, and just the thuds. I think how many thuds did you hear in this match? It had to have been close to a dozen.
No, I would think so. Yeah. I think that's probably about right. Maybe a little bit more than that. And even the forearms, they just smoke each other with the forearms. That we see all kinds of forearm battles now where the guys almost barely lean into each other and they look stupid, and they're in every single match right now. You would not want to be in these forearm battles. Like, they were knocking the taste out of each other's mouths. And it was, those were very, very rough. So very little rest for them. They would do this huge bump, and then their transition stuff to get to the next bump were stiff shots with chops and forearms. And Kobashi throws one of the stiffest chops that's ever been seen in wrestling. And Misawa was eating a bunch of those too. So no rest for these guys. It was just punishment after punishment.
What I did enjoy, though, was the selling between the two.
Yeah.
There was good timing here. They weren't really no selling too much. It's a little bit of it at the end, but I think it's just one of those, this is my last effort, I know the end is coming type deals.
Yeah.
I wish there was more of that today.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And now we get the thing where, you know, everybody kicks out at one and everybody takes the German suplex and gets up. And it's such a cliche. It doesn't really mean anything anymore. But these guys would take these things and they would sell it. And I mentioned Misawa's body language did it for him more than his face. Although late in this match, you see the exhaustion and he almost looks foggy, like his brain's a little scrambled, may have been, where he's just trying to put together the end. Kobashi had the same look, but Kobashi has these big eyes and, you know, his face is very, it emotes very, very well. And when he's in pain, the person in the last row understands everything that he's going through. And so that carried the crowd along for the ride because they knew what a trial this was for each guy.
They've been wrestling this style for at least 13 years at this point. Yeah. And you mentioned just the lack thereof, which almost is kind of a blessing in disguise here, of title defenses in All Japan, just in how important they were in the Triple Crown, because who in the world could sustain this type of punishment, we'll just say twice a month?
Yeah, no, yeah. Thank goodness you're right. They would do basically 3 week tours or so, maybe 4 week tours, and then end with the big show. And All Japan, in particular, it would be like the double tag team titles would headline one, and then the next one would be the Triple Crown. So the Triple Crown, you know, four or five defenses a year, not some, maybe six. I'd have to go back and just like check because there are resources where you can see that, but. Yeah, you don't want to do this style. The rest of the time, they were in kind of trios matches on the house shows. House shows would be trios matches where they could work a 15-minute match but only do five of it. And that probably preserved everybody's sanity and hospital bills.
Yeah, you had to. Oh, I mentioned the DDT on the ramp. I said Kobashi now going back to his famous chops as Misawa goes to a knee at this point. He Irish whips Misawa, but he counters the he counters the Irish whip, and Kobashi counters with the knee and hits two release dragon suplexes. So working on the neck, and he follows it up with a full Nelson. Misawa is in serious pain. Just good selling here overall, and the bumps just look nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They knew how to do this, and that was one thing. All Japan and Noah, their suplexes were some of the roughest in the whole business. And Kobashi was giving, and he was usually the guy that took them. He's taken some of the most famous head bumps off of suplexes. There's a match with Steve Williams that you watch through your fingers, even through today. You're like, oh, God. And Stan Hansen almost killed him a few times. Mm-hmm. But here he was giving them in a way that we don't always see Kobashi give them. But he was going in hard on Misawa, and Misawa was there for it, taking every single one of them hard.
Oh, so Misawa gets out of the full Nelson. Kobashi starts delivering chops. Finally, Misawa is beginning to no sell a few and just slaps the hell out of Kobashi at this point. They start trading chops and forearms, and it just, yeah, pace picks up once again. Oh, Kobashi with a back suplex for another two count. He goes for another suplex, but Misawa counters with forearms and hits a tiger suplex or a tiger driver 85 here at this point.
Yeah, I think it was, I thought it was a tiger suplex, but maybe it was a driver. But yeah, with Kobashi's arms pinned behind him.
Oh, Kobashi gets up, but Misawa starts hitting a series of forearms. Kobashi goes down. The crowd starts chanting for Kobashi.
Whoever's on his back is getting the chance. Whoever's on his back is getting the chance.
Oh, Misawa goes for a tiger driver 91. Kobashi blocks it. And if we get a tiger, this is a tiger driver 85 now. I believe it's the first one for a two count. You get a tiger suplex once again for a two count. And I wrote in all caps, this one was nasty.
Yeah, it was harsh. And the crowd is starting to come up because they're starting to believe we may get a finish anytime now. They weren't, had a ways to go. But they were starting to believe.
Could you believe that the pace that these guys were now setting at this point again,
cardio
just
monsters.
Later in their career? Yeah,
cardio monsters. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's they did that over and over again. You know that they would do 30-minute draws during the tournament time to save for dramatic purposes and also just to save jobs for guys, you know, not to pin them too often and things. But they, these guys can go 30 minutes and it was not 15 minutes of reverse gen locks. It was go, go, go.
No. Misawa locks on, and I can't recall the move. It was some sort of arm stretch. And oh, it didn't quite look like a stretch plum. I mean, that's just more of like a torque and a couple of, I think, releasing the hold and applying it back on. But he locked on a stretch, like a modified abdominal stretch, and then he hit another Tiger Driver 85 for a two. Then a few, probably 30 seconds later, Kenta hits a dragon suplex, another one that just looked vicious, and locks on a sleeper hold. So we mentioned the arm with Misawa working on Kobashi. Kobashi, in turn, is working on the neck of Misawa.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic storytelling. And you see them sell the effects of it more and more as the match goes on, telling you that every bit of this is starting to work in both directions. You know, when Kobashi has a few seconds, he'll grab his arm and grimace in pain a little bit. They're careful about showing the cumulative effect, and that just adds to the drama.
Now, I mentioned the sleeper hold. A few seconds later, Kobashi turns it into another release suplex with Misawa landing on his head for probably the third time in the match, and Kobashi with the forearm. Oh, just, yeah, I'm literally just cringing at this point, but also just in awe of what these two are putting together.
Yeah, they're very, very, very tough men, and just it shows a level of trust between the two of them also to even let somebody do things like this to you. Be fair. I mean, they must have absolutely trusted one another I do this, I'll get the bump right, but, you know, you wouldn't necessarily leave that to anyone, but these guys know each other very, very well.
This part of the match, I think, worked for me as well. Kobashi hitting his lariat for a two count. But after the two count, both men just laid down motionless for about 20 seconds or so.
Yeah, the lariat was, that came later for Kobashi. That was not one of his finishers in All Japan, for instance. You mentioned the moonsault and things. And he had a couple of others, but he jumped off the top a lot. In All Japan, he won the Triple Crown by hitting a leg drop off the top on Taue for the first time. That was the lariat came later. So we had seen a lot of the moves: Tiger Driver 85, Tiger Driver 91, All Japan stuff. But what we hadn't seen yet are the moves that they're using big time in Noah. They're coming. Don't have them yet, but we're starting to build to that. So now Kobashi's starting to pull out the new stuff. He's like, all right, well, I tried the classics on Misawa, and they're not working. I need to pull out the big guns. And he ended up working a pretty stiff lariat. The good news about a lariat is, if you know how to take a lariat, it's fairly safe. As long as you put it in the right spot on the chest, the other guy, the guy takes the bump. Misawa took good bumps for it. And so, yeah, now we're starting to see the later stuff, the stuff off the new album.
You're seeing the sweat. Every time these guys are hitting forearms and chops just knocked off of each other. Shout out to Justin Joint, who I know is listening. He's a huge fan of sweaters. Plenty of that in this match.
A lot of sweat.
They both roll out to the ramp. Kobashi goes for a suplex to the ramp.
We know what's coming. If you know this match, you know what's coming. It blows my mind every single time, though. But you're about to get to it. Pardon me.
Oh, for sure. Misawa reverses it into a suplex onto the ramp of his own.
There's no picnic either. We're not even to the rough part yet.
No. Oh, no. It's very, very close. Misawa with a diving forearm to the outside on the ramp. So I believe he came in, went back into the ring, and came back out.
Yeah, almost like a tope suicida, except he went an exceeding distance, like a little farther than you'd think he could go. And Kobashi is down on one knee, which gives him the right angle. But he dives through the middle and top rope and goes a long way considering how deep into the match they are, and clobbers Kobashi with a forearm that when he starts the move, you think he can't reach him. He did reach him.
Like I said, they turned back the clock on this night in 2003.
Yep.
And here we go, by the way. Misawa goes for a tiger suplex. Kobashi blocks it. And then this is the big one. Misawa breaks through with a dragon suplex from the ramp to the floor, and Kenta Kobashi lands on his head.
impossible.
This does not do it justice.
No, it's an impossible move. Like, as soon as he locks it in, you are 100% convinced that he's going to break out of that. There's just no way in the world he's going to take that move from the, no way are they going to do it. And then he does it. And not only does he do it, he doesn't, it's not even really released the way you normally do. He takes that thing right on the back of his head. It's an incredible bump. It's scary. They should never have done it. But it's a terrifying moment, no matter how many times you watch it.
Oh my gosh. I knew, yeah, I lost it at this point, even though I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
Both men, of course, selling this greatly, and rightfully so, though the ref starts the 20 count, the famed 20 count. Get all the way up to 18, Misawa finally rolls in. 19, Kobashi rolls in at about 19 and a half, and this was when that worked, and it should have anyway. I mean, he just took one of the most devastating moves we've probably ever seen.
Yeah, they work that well. It's done now where the guy plays it up so much, but Kobashi kind of oozed into the ring instead of just suddenly exploded into it. And the way the guys do it now, they're like 19 and then they dive in and heroically. And it still kind of works in Japan now the way it used to. But here he almost is just like crawling. He looks like the guys in the cartoons in the desert crawling toward the oasis. He's just kind of barely pulling himself into the ring, and he is barely picking his feet up to roll into the thing. So selling it again beautifully, like he was almost killed, because he was almost killed.
Oh. And at this point, Misawa crawls over for the cover and gets a two count. The crowd once again is going nuts.
Yeah. And you say nuts. Look at the background. There are people jumping up and down in their seat. I mean, not just cheering, not just pumping their fists in the air. There are people leaping into the air for this. And not just on their feet. You don't see that much now.
And there's more coming. There is more. There isn't much more, but there is more. Yeah. I did point out a young Kenta at ringside trying to encourage Kobashi.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that? Yeah. Yeah. Young Kenta down there. And that was when he was in incredible shape. He was almost an Ishimori shape. He had that build and things. That was before the injuries piled up on him as well. You know, So by the way, super nice guy. I got to talk to him for a little while. We happened to be in the same hotel when I was there for that Wrestle Kingdom, and super nice guy, really a kind, really kind to fans. And you can't say enough good things about Kenta.
That's fantastic, especially since he made his way back after his unfortunate United States run. But that's what you get when you sign with Stamford, Connecticut.
Yeah, he got some nasty shoulder injuries and not a whole lot else out of that run.
Mm-hmm. Very, very unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I lost it. Here it is right here. Yep. So Misawa hits I believe a Shining Wizard knee. I think that's what that was. It was definitely a very high knee, and he gets a two count. Mm-hmm. So a few seconds later, Kobashi with a big chop. Both guys are stumbling. We get two spinning back elbows, and then Misawa breaks out the Emerald Flosion.
Now we've come to the modern day. Now he's using his current finisher. He's tried everything he's ever used in the past. It ain't working. I need the new move on Kobashi. First time we've seen it in this match.
Yeah. So the Tiger Driver 85 was way back. The Tiger Driver 91, he's tried multiple times, and Kobashi's blocked it. Unable to block the Emerald Flosion. We get the one, we get the two. Kobashi kicks out at about 2.9. This is unprecedented. The first time anyone has ever kicked out of Misawa's Emerald Flosion finisher.
Yeah, and a lot of people in that building were convinced that was the end.
If I had been watching it back then, I probably would have said this match is over.
Sure, yes. Yeah, no. I mean, that was the message they were sending. It said, oh, we finally hit the biggie. But nope, Kobashi's still alive.
Once again, crowd is still going crazy. You mentioned it with people in the background just jumping up and down with this. Now, Misawa, after a few seconds, goes for another Tiger Driver 91.
Mm-hmm.
Can't hit it. Kobashi just, almost drops to a knee at this point, but he's blocked him multiple times. Finally, Misawa goes for it again, but Kobashi reverses it with a back body drop. Gets out of it. A few seconds later, Misawa goes for a clothesline or a lariat. Kobashi counters with his own lariat and gets a two count. How is he mustering up the energy after taking that dragon suplex to the outside and the Emerald Flosion.
Yeah, and Misawa is selling everything by not doing a big dramatic kick out. He's barely getting his shoulder. Everything they're doing is taking the quote unquote last ounce of their strength.
That's the one thing these days that's missing in so many matches.
Now, if they did that thing now in AEW in particular, it's a one count. It's a one count and then the guy pops up. That type of thing. And it's no, they sold it. They sold it instead.
All right. I'm going to pivot for 1 second. How many one counts would you do in a year?
Maybe one. I don't particularly care for them. I don't think it's a, I think it's a miss. I think it's a missed dramatic moment. I don't think it's that dramatic. I'm not a big fan of one counts anywhere, really. I don't think they make a whole lot of sense. And I think all it does is make whatever happened just look weak.
I'd maybe do it once every couple of years.
Yeah, certainly not much, and maybe only in very specific circumstances. But I mean, how devastating could the move be if the guy only gets a one count out of it? It's just, to me, it just hurts the move.
It really does. Again, that makes me love this match so much, and we're finally getting to the end, and I'm kind of sad at this point. Kobashi hits a brain buster after he hits the lariat, and again, Misawa kicks out at two. Drops him directly on his head for probably the fourth time in the match.
Like he's planting the flag back in a golf hole straight up and down. Like, it's just nasty.
So, again, just... I highly encourage everybody, I'll say it again, but when the match ends, which is coming very quickly, to go and watch this match. I will give you the link and just how you just watch it for yourself. And I wrote after that, after Misawa kicks out at two, I wrote "this crowd" in 3 exclamation points. Mm-hmm. High fever pitch again. We're sensing the end. Kobashi finally gets Misawa on his shoulders and he hits his new finishing maneuver, the burning hammer.
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3. Mm. Kenta Kobashi has done it. He is now the GHC heavyweight champion in Pro Wrestling Noah. He is exhausted. Head is lying on Misawa's stomach. Eyes are almost rolled in the back of his head, but not quite. What were some of your thoughts as the burning hammer finish came into play here?
Well, the burning hammer was one of those moves that you hope they didn't do in every match. Like, and thankfully it was just his big match finisher. There are compilations of all of Kobashi's burning hammers. He didn't do it all that much. Thank goodness. It's a dangerous move right there, but it does look like what it was meant to be, which is an utter kill shot. And it's being turned into a transition move now, but that's the story of every finisher in the world. I mean, the vertical suplexes used to be a finisher, and I'm not trying to say that we can't evolve and all that kind of stuff, but hard to explain when you saw a burning hammer back then, just what a kill shot that was. And because he didn't finish off every opponent with it, he didn't do it every match. He only brought it out in emergencies only. And what's a bigger emergency than the GHC heavyweight title match with Misawa? It was just another signal to the fans that you were watching something extraordinarily important, that he doesn't pull this out to win a trios match in Niigata. You know, this is for a Budokan Hall main event world title match. And he is desperate. He's in terrible pain. He knows that he is one move away from losing this thing. So it's time to swing for the fences, to use a baseball cliche. And that's what the burning hammer was. You don't do the burning hammer if you're okay. You do the burning hammer if you have no other choice. And that was always how Kobashi portrayed it. He brings it out here and beats the legendary Misawa with it. And a new champion is crowned after so long. You needed something, and he was legitimate. I mean, we all knew that Kobashi was the real deal. And after a match like this, how can you do anything but respect the new champion? It did everything it was meant to do.
33 and a half minutes. Yep. Kobashi emerges victorious. And Dave Meltzer, 5 stars, Wrestling Observer Newsletter Match of the Year 2003. For me, easy 5. I was absolutely, from start to finish, eyes were glued. The storytelling was great, like I mentioned, with the limbs and breaking out the big moves, but also like selling, I think, to perfect points in this, and two men knowing each other so well, and where the crowd was at in this, and just the passing of the torch. And with the passing of the torch, I will ask you this question as well. Mm-hmm. did, I mean, hindsight 2020 now, yes, Misawa made the right decision, but he was inches away from making Jun Akiyama that guy, the ace in Noah.
Yeah.
I mean, this right move here for sure, going with Kobashi for the next 2 years.
Yeah. I mean, again, you just didn't know if you were ever going to get a chance to do it. And so I think it is. Plus, Akiyama a little bit younger. And I think Misawa just thought we still have some time with Akiyama. It turned out to be correct. And once Kobashi, well, I mean, he ended up having a bout with cancer later. Kobashi went through a lot in his life. And all those injuries and things, they did pile up. He got some classics from Kobashi during this time. The good feelings toward Kobashi from the crowd, had he lost this one and never gotten that title, I feel like the fans wouldn't have turned on Misawa and Noah, but I think there would have been a thing of like, man, I can't believe that never happened. It would have been a miss. You know, there would have been something amiss, and that would have been a miss with Noah had Kobashi never gotten to the top there and held that title, because he was such a key part of Noah being, at the time, best promotion in the world, which I think it was during this time. And New Japan had kind of fallen on its ear a little bit. American wrestling was doing pretty well for WWF was anyway, doing good business. Maybe not, you know, Steve Austin business, but and The Rock had gone to Hollywood and all that stuff, but things were still pretty good. But I think Noah was the best wrestling. And he was a huge part of that. So if you don't go with him here, does it ever happen? And then that's kind of a, you end up talking about the, him as the best guy that never got that belt. He had held the Triple Crown, so it wouldn't have been empty, but they would have just said, boy, Misawa never gave that to Kobashi. That's crazy. You know, and it kind of checks that box. And Kobashi's run was pretty good with it. And he did manage to move it to Akiyama, which worked also. So they got a lot of good years out of this.
They got a little bit lucky, as I mentioned, with of the injuries from 2000 to 2003. Yeah. I mean, Misawa.
There's luck there, too. You're right.
Oh, gut instinct, though, to go with this. But the way he was crowned, you could not have painted a better story in this match to crown him as the guy.
It needed to be an epic thing like that. And the fact they were able to pull that out, you're just 100%. Even the Misawa fans were behind Kobashi as champion once that match wore off. They're just like, well, we've got a real man as champion. That guy is a champion. No ifs, ands, or buts. And a match like that will do this.
Gone was the Orange Crush, by the way, which I forgot to mention pre-match. And now he's got the black trunks and the black boots and the black knee pads.
I miss the orange.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got a lot of Kenta Kobashi matches coming down the line here as we go through 2026. I got his match with Samoa Joe in October.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of my favorites. I watch it yearly on the day too.
Oh, cool.
You mentioned Stan Hansen. That was like July 29th, 1993.
Great one. Oh goodness. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just the physicality of it all there too. So, you mentioned Kobashi and cancer, Mitsuhara Misawa I believe it was 2009 died in the ring.
Yeah.
And he had written a letter at some point before this had ever happened and said, give this to the person that ends up killing me in the ring. He had an intuition that he was likely going to die in the ring and just basically was saying, this is not your fault.
Wow.
This is kind of the way I wanted to go.
Well, you know, the thing with Misawa, the move that did it wasn't even a bad bump. It's just a classic example of one bump too many. And there's a line that Jim Ross said is that you never know how many punches you have left on your bump card. And then one day it's the last one. And for some people, it's like Dynamite Kid's back going out and he's never the same. Or, there's 100 examples of guys that just got hurt and could never quite come back. But for this one, Misawa, it wasn't a crazy bump. But all of those crazy bumps just added up, and it was exactly the wrong mix, and we lost. I was very sad, and I was surprised, but I can't say I was even stunned. You know, just like, well, you know, if anyone was going to die in the ring, the way that guy wrestled, unfortunately, it wasn't shocking, but, you know, you're always surprised when something like that happens and deeply, deeply sad. but that style is not sustainable. And Kenta Kobashi is not 60 years old. He was born in 1967, I think, right? And he walks like he's 90. And we're seeing a lot of that strong style come home to roost. I watched the Tanahashi retirement ceremony when guys as young as Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi and Will Ospreay hobbled to the ring to greet him. And that high impact stuff looks great. And in the moment, it'll make the audience feel like nothing else. And then all that comes home. And, you know, when I see Kobashi barely able to walk around now or really struggling to, he runs his own promotion and he's still very active in the wrestling business, but you see every one of these bumps all these years later. And we saw a lot of them here that needed to come home to roost eventually, because you just can't do that to the human body, what they were doing to each other.
Probably nine times they drop each other on their heads and necks in this match.
Incredible. And look, I love these guys, and this is an absolutely incredible match, but yeah, it does have a different perspective to it now, but they gave us their bodies. They gave us their bodies. And the crowd there at Budokan Hall that night left emotionally exhausted and thrilled. And not many things can have that kind of an impact on people, and both an impact on the an emotional impact on the audience and a physical impact on the participants.
Again, March 1st, 2003. This is the first five-star match I have covered in this project, and rightfully so. Yeah, it earned every billing and then some. I mean, I'm actually moderately surprised that Dave, because he broke the scale for Kawada Misawa. He maybe could have done it here.
Yeah, could have. You know, the star ratings thing is always going to be a bone of contention. It's very, very subjective, but I would have a hard time with anyone who watched this match and went, meh, you know, taking their opinion too seriously. It's just, to me, this is one of the true no-brainer, great, all-time great matches.
Yeah. Highly recommend going out of your way to watch it. I will give people a preview of, I believe it's going to be next week we're going to be covering this. We're going to yet another five-star match coming to America. Bret Hart, Steve Austin, WrestleMania 13.
I was in the building. I was in the building for that one too.
Oh, Chicago. My goodness.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. That was another one where every move, the crowd, because that one had a divided crowd too, because the Austin was starting to take off and a lot of people loved him. Bret Hart was still had a big following. I was a Bret Hart guy, and every single blow, every single move, whoever was delivering it, that half of the crowd popped. That was an atmosphere that was unlike much else I've felt live. Best match I've ever seen in person. Let's say that. And that's a heck of a ride, that one. And just a brilliantly executed double turn and everything. That was, you're going to love dissecting that one. That was so much fun.
I completely forgot, because you had mentioned to me that you lived in Chicago for a bit of time.
Near enough. The people in Chicago, Chris Sampson in particular, would shun me if I said I was a Chicago guy, because I wasn't. I didn't have the address. It's not a Chicago address. But yeah, I lived in the area, so I went to WrestleMania 2, WrestleMania 8 in Indianapolis, and 13.
Okay, so yeah, you got to see the Dynamite, so you got to see the British Bulldogs beat Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake at WrestleMania.
I got the best set of matches, because I got the Battle Royal with all the Chicago Bears, which were heroes among heroes. So I got to see William Perry, and then the Bulldogs match, and then WrestleMania 8 was rough, but but then 13 had that match with Austin and Hart that made up for it. So
Savage, Flair, and Piper and Bret Hart held up, though, for WrestleMania 8.
Yeah, those were really good. You know, the funny thing about WrestleMania 13 was the hot dog match, for me and a lot of other people, because the concession stands and the bathrooms were full, was the Sultan versus Rocky Maivia, which would go on to do much better later on in life. But at the time, everyone was like, yeah, let's go get something to eat.
Rikishi and Dwayne Johnson.
Yeah, better things ahead. But at the time, they were just if you were going to miss something, that was the one, the biggest movie star in the world. We all just said, "Ah, the hell with it." had we known, Jesse, had we known, we probably would have stuck around. And we probably would have stuck around for that one if we had known.
Hey, he had the athletic ability. You could tell there was some charisma, but they didn't allow it to really start to spew out of him until he decided to turn on the fans. Well, yeah. And rightfully so, because the fans were turning on him, saying, "Die, Rocky, die." And he's a promo artist. And yes, the most famous, probably Hollywood.
It worked out well for everybody in the long run. But yeah, there's Rocky moments there. Yeah.
Well, I think that's going to conclude this tour of Mitsuharu Misawa and Kenta Kobashi.
All right.
We did this thing justice. This was such a fun match.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was absolutely brilliant between two brilliant performers. And like you mentioned, Misawa's prime was probably the mid to late 90s was his absolute prime, but he pulled this one out because he knew he needed to. And Kobashi's prime was probably late 90s, that 98, 99, but he was great before and great after. So you mentioned they turned back the clock a little bit. Yes, they certainly did. But this was as good as anything either one ever did in their prime. Just as good as that. And it's startling that it's still a startling match. It holds up. And like I said, there are a couple moments in here where you just can't believe what you're seeing. And wrestling doesn't make you feel like that too often, but this match will do it.
Yeah. Well, I talked about it with you in January, and before I mention that, on your way out, mention projects, of course, Speaking a Strong Style, as well as Ringside Replay.
Yeah, Ringside Replay is my history website that I like to go back and look at wrestling week by week in the early 1980s, mostly 81, 82 era, and how the different territories interacted with one another, how guys would move from one to the other, and some of the booking patterns, and some of that fun stuff that we can see from a distance now. I like to look back at it. You can draw some lessons from today from it. So I really enjoy that. And then, of course, my show is Speaking of Strong Style with Jeremy Finestone. He's a great guy, a good friend of mine. And we do that every Thursday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. And you can find that on YouTube. And then it's a podcast, too. You can always find it on all the usual podcast stuff where we talk the current New Japan Pro Wrestling product.
I have to get that back into my regular rotation. I have hear your thoughts on Callum Newman.
Yeah, it's we have a lot of thoughts on Callum. It's a talented guy who has been put in the top foreign spot and has some work to do to convince everybody that he belongs there. I think he's talented enough to do it, but similar to David Finlay, when he first took that spot, there are a lot of skeptics just going, "Is he really the guy?" And so he's got work to do to get there. And but he has a big match coming up with Yota Tsuji for the world title where he can convince a lot of haters that he's ready for that main event spot. I think he might be, though.
Well, I mean, time's going to tell. Yeah, it's super exciting because there's a big transition time going on in New Japan.
Boy.
They need somebody to step up to the plate.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about what might be holding them back, and the call may be coming from inside the house.
Okay. Good segue to tune in later on. So I mentioned having you and Jeremy back. I think April sounds great because, as I mentioned in January, Kazuchika Okada, Katsuyori Shibata.
Woo.
Yeah, April 9th, 2017. And there's going to be so many ways we can go with this match and just kind of, even the aftermath and Shibata, politics, all of it. So much to break down on that one.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes. All right, folks. So hopefully you enjoyed this one. And that has been episode 209, TRN Unplugged. And as always, we'll see you.
Bari Hamada! Soko kara ikka! Toreru ka? Ato wa otosu dake! Furui mo toita! Ato 3 byo! Kobashi ga kachimashita! Bari Hamada!
Thank you. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.